Well, I think during the luncheon adjournment, the clock was adjusted so that it is now probably closer to all our watches. So I'm sorry if we're resuming a little late, but we thought we ought to make a little adjustment for that fact. But anyway, we're now ready to start working through section 5 of the agenda. I understand that I can't... Oh, yes, immediately to the right. The representative from London City Airport wanted, I think... has to get away at relatively early and wanted to raise the item number 10. Now, it may be that in a sense there's very little that needs to be said about item 10, that's Article 65, brackets 12, because I think the boroughs raised that as a matter that would be being pursued in the discussions as to the extent to which the public meetings provision should be applied. But if you'd like to perhaps just make your point there, but I think it may be a point that's already been taken on board as to be part of the discussions on the operation of STIG.
Thank you, sir. I'm grateful for accommodating me on timing. I'm Duncan Field, and I'm here representing London City Airport. I've been asked to address you on two matters of principle that relate to the drafting of the DCO. And I should say, my colleague Victoria Watson and the airport's transport consultant Rob Ruffin from Vectus will remain here this afternoon and will be able to assist or discuss matters of detail relating to DTO. But turning to the two matters of principle, both of which I have to say were probably foreshadowed by the airport's representations, and they both relate to the operation of STIG and its interaction with traffic mitigation measures. The first point is that in the context of STIG being a consultative body, we believe the airport is a glaring omission from its membership. The airport is a major transport facility in close proximity to Silvertown Tunnel, and although the airport is a private company, it is a licensed airport operator and a statutory undertaker. It has a direct and legitimate interest in all of the items listed in Article 65.5, especially the monitoring strategy, the traffic impacts mitigation strategy, and cross-river bus services. And in that regard, it regularly convenes an airport transport forum required as part of its planning obligations, and surface access is clearly critical to the proper functioning of the airport. That includes road access, despite the fact that it enjoys a very high level of public transport usage. And on that basis, the airport would wish to be a member of STIG. The second point I would like to address you on relates to the operation of STIG and the requirement relating to the monitoring strategy and the TIMS. The airport's concerned that as STIG and the requirements operate together, there is no assurance that necessary traffic mitigation measures will be delivered on the ground. In particular, whilst it welcomes the inclusion of mitigation triggers in the latest version of the TIMS, there is a question mark over the process for examining if mitigation is required, what that mitigation should be, and when it will be undertaken, because that all of those matters are entirely within the control of the applicant without any independent control or oversight. We certainly accept that the role of STIG is vital in implementing TIMS, but it is only a consultative body as it stands, with no right of approval, and as Article 65.6 makes clear, Transport for London only have to have regard to any recommendation made by STIG. And so we find ourselves in the slightly unusual position that Transport for London as an applicant will itself determine whether triggers for mitigation have been reached, whether permanent or temporary mitigation is required, whether the requirement for mitigation is solely or largely attributable to the scheme, and therefore whether it will carry out mitigation. It also decides the type of mitigation that should be required and when that should be undertaken and funded. We note there is a limited role for local authorities where those measures affect local roads, but even in those circumstances, the implementation of those measures has to be approved by the local authority, but the local authority can only choose whether to approve that measure or refuse and carry out and pay for its own mitigation. This is an unusual situation, we would say, where mitigation has not been identified or built into the scheme, and with that in mind, the airport considers there needs to be a much more rigorous requirement to ensure that all reasonable and necessary mitigation is brought forward and delivered, with independent oversight from the relevant planning authorities, while still being informed by the input from STIG. I think reference was made earlier to the possibility that STIG could give binding recommendations. That's clearly one alternative. Another, which the airport would suggest, would be to require Transport for London to obtain the approval of the relevant planning authorities to the output of the monitoring strategy and TIMS, including any proposed mitigation and programme of work, at three key stages of the project, before scheme commencement, before scheme opening, and 3 years after opening. And then Transport for London should be required to undertake any approved mitigation in accordance with the approved programme. The airport doesn't accept that these matters should be left to Transport for London alone, even though it has a statutory role as highway authority. That role and its duties involve many conflicting considerations: availability of funding and prioritising measures across the entire TfL road network and not just Silvertown Tunnel and the local roads. And we say that those conflicting duties risk the timely delivery of necessary mitigation works for this project. And we would point to an example where the Highway Authority has promoted its own scheme and given a right of approval to planning authorities over future mitigation works. And that example is the Norfolk County Council Norwich Northern Distributor Road DCO. So, as I mentioned, there are other matters of detail which may be raised by the airport in the context of more detailed discussions, but those are the two principles that the airport wished to make clear.
Thank you very much indeed. As I said earlier, I think the generality of the points that you're making are ones that have been raised and are going to be pressed. You may have put, in a sense, more flesh on the concerns than the more general points that were made by the boroughs earlier. But I'm not sure whether you want to come back, Mr. Owen, or would accept that these are all matters that would be open for discussion. Not saying that you will necessarily agree to them, but that they would be fed into the discussions that are due to be held.
Robbie Owen, Transport for London. Yes, sir, happy to feed that all in. I think that Mr. Field, the first point Mr. Field made is a very different one to the second point.
Well, indeed, it's a specific request for a
Well, it is, and of course, Transport for London's having to respond to lots of requests for people to become members of STIG, and the philosophy to date has been that the local authorities are there to represent businesses and others within their areas, and notwithstanding that London City Airport is what it is, the view to date has been that principle holds good, but we will take it away and consider it further. I would just say, in the meantime, there is the provision in Article 65.10, paragraph 10, for STIG to establish committees, subcommittees, and working groups for any purpose it considers appropriate and appoint their membership, which may include persons who aren't actually members of STIG, in effect, and that STIG can delegate any of its functions to any such committee, subcommittee, or working group. And I just point that out because that may be what we end up saying is a way forward here, because there are lots of businesses and others who can say they're in a particular special position. But as I say, they're not the local authority, and therefore we have predominantly chosen membership reference to local authorities. Highways England is the one exception, I suppose, given its role on the Dartford River crossing, but you appreciate the relationship between the Dartford crossing and Silvertown and Blackpool.
There is clearly a relation, though in some ways there is also a link with the city airport as a licensed airport and statutory undertaker, so there is a link.
Not
the same, but
yes,
there is.
I understand, sir. So, we will give it further consideration. And the second, rather more fundamental point, I think, is different to the ones that we've agreed this week to consider further in terms of the workings of STIG and reviewing the wording and effect of the monitoring strategy, TIMS, and the charging policy and procedures document. As part of that, we will consider what further tightening up and assurances we can give as to the delivery of mitigation. We understand it is important to that everyone is as confident as can be expected at this stage about the mitigation. We've heard what Mr. Field has said on behalf of the airport, and I think at this stage that's really all I can say. It's not a point we've had notice of before, so far as I understand. That may be incorrect, but certainly I and my immediate colleagues working on the project weren't aware of that. That's probably all I can say at this moment in time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Owen. Obviously, I need to refresh my memory over what was put into the Norwich NDR on this particular point. Clearly, I think the issue of the potential of binding recommendations did come up this morning as a matter that to be fed into the negotiations, not necessarily one that you are necessarily acceding to, but that one is at least a common point that did come in. But I think all we can suggest as the panel that we look forward to the outcome of these discussions and deliberations, and we'll have to come to conclusions on if there are outstanding unresolved points. So thank you very much. Thank you.
Mr. Owen, Lillian Harrison, one of the examining inspectors. Further question on that, if I may. We understand that you're going to be in further discussions with the host boroughs and possibly others about the role and the frequency of meetings for STIG, etc. Will we get an update on where your discussions have got to by deadline 3?
Robbie Owen, Transport for London. We will put in the post-hearing note what we can, although I understand the next meeting with the boroughs isn't until after deadline 3. And therefore, I think it's unlikely we'll be able to give you a great deal. But we can certainly indicate the areas we're looking at in terms of, with a bit more specificity than we have this week, the areas we're looking at of the DCO that we think would be welcomed in terms of change.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, now perhaps we can go through the earlier items, some of which will be duplicated by the points that were carried over from yesterday, some of which are separate points that have not been discussed this week. The first one was the question really of the definition of the project and the suggestion that in terms of we are obviously in this particular general one moving into requirements immediately, but it is a general point about links to the design and access statement and indeed the general arrangement drawings. They are perhaps two separate points, because I say we've noted that the design and access statement is actually referenced in the design principles, which is a certified document, and it's that document says that that is to be read in conjunction with the design and access statement. So it seems therefore slightly puzzling that one is certified and one isn't certified. But that's the narrower point. The wider point is whether the requirements 3.1 and 3.4 should require regard to be had to these documents. It's not suggesting that they should be in conformity with them, because that would perhaps be too strong a test, as I think your argument is that you're in a sense almost like at an outline application stage here rather than... But the purpose, I think, with outline applications is to have design and access statements that do govern what the subsequent work scheme is going to be worked up. So that's really the point that we would like to hear from the applicant, and obviously from other parties once you've heard the applicant's response to those points.
Robbie Owen, Transport for London. So if I can take the two documents in turn, first of all, the design and access statement. Paragraph 1.2.3 of the design principles document does refer to the DAS because the DAS provides an example of how the design principles could be applied, and I stress could, and we think this means that third parties would be able to understand the practical application of these principles, but it doesn't mean, in our view, that the DAS should be taken to be part of or in some way packaged with the design principles. And indeed, the design principles were deliberately extracted from the DAS and separated out to isolate what were the design principles. In our view, therefore, the DAS does not need to be certified. It's what you might call a sort of second generation document which the DCO doesn't directly refer to, and think you need to draw the line somewhere. And as Mr. Humphreys was explaining yesterday, with reference to the Statutory Instruments Act 1946, the accepted approach is to certify the documents that the statutory instrument directly refers to, but if you carried on at the next level down, the level after that, there would never be an end. And I think that that's the view we've got on that. The general arrangement drawings is really a similar position we feel. In contrast to the works plans, the land plans, and the engineering section drawings, which set out the parameters for the works and the land take for the scheme, the general arrangement drawings give only an illustration of how the scheme could be developed within the constraints and parameters set by the DCO and its certified plans. So in that respect, it's similar to the construction method statement, I suppose. So it's really for these reasons, and we set those out in our response to written question DC 91, that we don't think at the moment that it would be appropriate for these plans to be certified, given their purpose and role. It may be, sir, just one remaining point that we come to discuss requirement 6, I'm sure, in due course, and we have said that we're giving a bit more consideration to the treatment of landscaping. It may be in that context that we would wish to refer to the general arrangement drawings, but we haven't yet finished that piece of work. But for the time being, and certainly in respect of the DAS, we feel that it wouldn't be appropriate for that to be certified.
Without either of those two documents, where in any of the documentation that would be certified Is there actually an illustration of the external appearance of the scheme that is proposed? We'll come on to the limits of deviation in a moment as to, you know, tying down actually where the scheme is proposed to be. But in terms of illustrating its appearance, those are surely in the general arrangement drawings and the design and access statement. There are only sort of snippets in the design principles of, you know, that it's the quality and stuff that is anticipated.
So I think, sorry, Michael Humphreys. So I think I would approach it in this sense. The purpose of the order is to, as it's a piece of legislation, is to set the legal parameters of what we are authorized to carry out under the order. And clearly, as part of that, there may need to be further approvals given by the authorities in pursuance of the particular requirements. Obviously, as part of the application material, there's a lot more than is actually referred to in the order, and that includes representations, illustrative representations, indicative representations of what we think will come forward within those legal parameters that are given by the works plans and the various other provisions. One of the benefits of certifying a document, and you can see this in Article 64.3, is, and this is based on the model provisions, is that it makes it clear that a plan or document certified is admissible in any proceedings as evidence of the contents. Now, why is that important? That's important because non-compliance with an order, and by extension, one of the certified documents, is a criminal offence. And therefore, it's important, if there was a prosecution for non-compliance with the order or non-compliance with the documents, that a court could be satisfied, because it's a criminal offence that is involved in that case, that the document it was looking at is actually the document. It is, in effect, part of the order. Now, the illustrative material, whether it be in the design or access statement or the general arrangement plans, is not something that the promoter is bound to. They are, in each case, illustrative of what we anticipate will be the scheme that will come forward within the very tight legal parameters set by the works plans and the various other limits of deviation and so on. And so, whereas, of course, there are many documents, as you rightly indicate, that indicate what the scheme is likely to look for, there's a distinction in a sense between that, on the one hand, and the legal parameters, on the other, within which we can bring forward the scheme. And, you know, it's, I think in a sense I would try and characterize that as the sort of the rationale between these two different things and why we are very happy, of course, to commit through the works plans and various other plans, sections and so on to certain parameters, but wouldn't be, and frankly couldn't be committed to the precise illustrations of what that might look for. Those are things that will ultimately come forward, where appropriate, through the approvals of the local authorities in each individual case. Does that kind of help on what I see as the distinction?
It helps, I think, on the distinction, though I'm not sure that it really explains why there cannot be phrases like "have regard to these documents" rather than obviously, what you're saying means they can't have adherence to those documents.
I think the point is this, and I'll hand back in a moment to Mr. Owen, obviously. But as Mr. Owen explained, what we did with the design access statement is then pull out those elements that actually set the principles, the parameters, if you like, not visual parameters on a plan in that case, but parameters in terms of design principles, to which we will be legally bound. But obviously it is a matter for us to bring forward the scheme and design it in accordance with those parameters, and as you know, this is a design-build project, and the contractor will bring forward the scheme, but will be tightly constrained.
I think it's this phrase, tightly constrained, that is what is perhaps troubling us. I haven't actually got the design principles document in front of me, and obviously I could dial it up on the machine, but it takes longer time than probably valuable to make the point. But, I mean, there are sort of aspects of the design principles that sort of say it must be well designed and satisfy our design panel and people like that, which really doesn't give a lot of guidance as to what it would be like at all. And therefore, as I say, we're really wondering how tightly defined the project is by what is currently either in the order or in documents and or requirements. And that is, as I say, what is troubling us a little. I mean, in terms of, for instance, the environmental statement and what is assessed, that does include visual matters and not just air quality and noise and matters of that nature.
Of course.
Clearly, I suppose, what is in the tunnel itself, unless you're going to go through it, you don't see it. But there are aspects of this that are clearly going to be seen. Requirement four, yes, does require approval at the moment only of certain features from the planning authorities. There is no guidance on what basis that approval would be sought. No tightly defined guidance on what that would be sought.
I think so. I mean, of course, we can go away and take this away. I did refer earlier to the approval by the authorities, and obviously that would be within the context of not only all the works plans and the limits of deviation and what we were allowed to do, but also the design principles. But requirement 4.1 does say the construction of any permanent above-ground buildings and structures must not commence until the details of the siting, design and external appearance of those permanent above-ground buildings and structures have been submitted to and approved in writing by the relevant planning authority. And then we have to carry out the development in accordance with that. So it is...
And then subsection 3 takes away a lot of that by confining it to certain features only. But
yes, I think... I would need to recheck all of those, but I think those are fairly limited carve-outs, as I recall.
It's the other way around. They're not carve-outs. They're the only things that are caught by it. It's not excluding those things. It's saying that that's what it means. We're not totally convinced as to why you can't just rely on sort of GPDO definitions of what is development, and that would be subject to approval. I think you're aware of our concern, and perhaps in responding to today. But before that, I don't know whether I can see Greenwich want to come in. I don't know whether any of the other boroughs or others would like to comment. Kim Smith.
Thank you, sir. Kim Smith, Greenwich. Our initial response to this was that we would require the documents to be in conformity with. After hearing your comments, I think have regard to would give us a level of comfort which would be adequate. The primary concern we have here is any proposed changes to the designs could end up with a very different scheme to the scheme which is currently being examined. I was going to come on to this part later, and it's in relation to consents, agreements and approvals, which is Article 68, subsection 2, which is a deemed approval within 28 days of any submission. Initially, at the last DCO hearing, Greenwich indicated it would be happy for a deemed approval of highways issues, but a deemed approval of any major submission which could relate to a change in the design of the structure, to have a 28-day deemed approval, we would not consider to be appropriate.
Right. I don't see anyone else wishing to come in. So I don't know whether that is purely a Greenwich view or whether there is other boroughs that have either the same or a contrary view.
James Burton, London Borough of Newham. Just to say that we're in discussions with TfL about this. Our concern is more about what is submitted pursuant to that fourth requirement. We would like a statement of conformity which sets out how it complies with requirement three. And I think that's generally accepted by TfL. I don't want to speak on their behalf, but those discussions are positive at this point. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Could I just, coming from Tower Hamlets' point of view, just to concur with the other two boroughs about, I think we support the idea of have regard to, as you're suggesting.
So I think unless item 4.3 is amended, I don't think there's probably anything within Tower Hamlets that actually, you know, is physical. There might be gantry signs and road signs and things like that, which may or may not be covered either now or I don't think they would be covered now, but would be. I doubt if even if they would be on a wider definition, but as they would be highway authority permitted development usually. But
take into account the wider environment, sir. Just what happens.
I understand the point. Mr. Owen.
Sir, thank you. Just on that last point, I should refer you to paragraph 16 of Schedule 2, which deals with the procedure for applying for discharge of requirements, and it does involve a consultative mechanism with Tower Hamlets in relation to applications that clearly aren't in their area but may affect them.
Yeah.
Can I just also deal quickly with the point
made Article
by...
Article 58. Are you going to refer to the Article 58 point?
68, wasn't it?
68, sorry. Yes, it is 68.
I was, yes.
Yeah.
Article 68, which was inserted at deadline 1, as you may recall, specifically does not apply, and 68.4 makes this very clear, it does not apply to any application for discharge of requirements under Part 1 of Schedule 2 or indeed to any applications under protective provisions. So it is confined to the various consents required under the works provisions of the order. That's Part 2 of the order. So I hope that helps perhaps deal with that point that you just heard. But I think so in conclusion on this point is Mr. Humphrey said we're tethered away and give it some further consideration.
Thank you very much.
There was also just, I don't know if you're going to come to it, but the last sentence of the agenda item referring to the stakeholder design consultation group. Would you like me to deal with that now?
Oh, yes, please.
I think in short, we agree with the point and we will refer to the stakeholder design consultation group in requirement 3.2 in the revised version going in at deadline 3. So that would mean that TfL would have to engage with the stakeholder design consultation group during the detailed design process, just as it will have to with the Siltown Tunnel Design Review Panel.
Thank you very much. Thank you. In a sense, there's a similar narrow point over the page, at the top of page 4 of the agenda, well, if it's printed out in the same way on yours as mine, that the design principles are said to only apply to noise barriers within the order limits. Well, we've got the saga of the Siebert road barriers and Invicta road barriers, which are outside the order limits. Would not the design principles also apply to those?
Robbie Owen, TfL. These are the barriers that we were discussing yesterday, of course, Siebert Road. Our view is that, that is not appropriate because those barriers outside the order limits are not part of the scheme. They're not mitigation required by the scheme. They are barriers that Transport for London is prepared to install, as you've heard, and that will be through a separate legal agreement. But on the basis that the environmental statement, as you heard yesterday, does not identify those barriers outside the limits as being necessary mitigation, the environmental statement only identifies barriers by the tunnel portals as being required, then we think it's appropriate that the design principles do not refer to the barriers beyond the limits because they're not part of the scheme.
I can understand that as a theory, but the way the design principles are drafted, it's saying, you know, they've got to be effective and look good and so on and so forth. By saying that these principles don't apply to other barriers, you are sort of implying that anything goes for those. Now, I'm sure that's not either the intent or the reality. It just seems a sort of an odd phraseology.
Well, sorry, Robbie Owen again. I think, you know, those barriers for Siebert Road will be treated in the same way as any other highway barriers to deal with noise and subject to the normal approvals, which would include consideration of design issues.
Austin Smith. I just want to ask, given this is a PPP scheme, does that have any bearing on the quality of design that might emerge either in the scheme itself or in these adjacent areas?
Robbie Owen, the contractor, the PPP contractor that Transport for London will appoint to construct the scheme will be subject to all of the commitments that we're here discussing, all of the requirements and protective provisions and the whole structure we're creating and discussing. So they will be in no better or worse position than were TfL to be implementing the order directly.
It's just the question of who makes the ultimate decision within a particular financial envelope.
Robbie Owen, well, of course, insofar as approvals are required under the requirements, so in relation to noise barriers under requirement 12, the project co, the PPP contractor, in liaison with its client, TfL, will clearly work up details to be approved under 12, but the approval is given by the planning authority in terms of the noise mitigation measures, including the design of any noise barriers. So I don't think that there will be any difference in terms of quality just because this is a PPP scheme.
Sir, could I just add a comment there, please? Kim Smith, Greenwich. We recognise that the barriers at Siebert and Invicta might actually have a different technical specification to the barriers closer to the portal. The fixing of them, I think, will be far more challenging. Having said that, we don't think it's unreasonable for the design of them to have regard to the design principles.
Robbie, and so just quickly on that point, it might be helpful just to say this, that that is a discussion we can have as part of discussing the legal agreement concerned, and see what we can provide through that medium to give the design guidance that might be helpful.
Peter, you might want to switch on your mic. Thanks.
Thank you. We had previously raised the issue that you have definitions in some part, you know, not just the ones in Article 2, and we really just wondered whether it might be helpful to include unless otherwise stated in there. It's a very small point. I don't know that we even need to discuss it. You can presumably reflect upon whether that would be helpful or not, but...
Robbie Owen, TFL. We're not averse to this. The question refers to any potential confusion. We're not sure there would be, because I think the order is already clear where different definitions, for example, in some schedules are used. Practice tends to wax and wane on this, and it's sometimes frowned upon nowadays to say this sort of thing. It's not something we feel strongly about, but as I say, I'm not sure there is any scope for potential confusion given what we've currently got, but we reflect on it further and come to a final view.
Well, obviously, as you say, things wax and wane on this. Some of those who advise us obviously are waxing rather than waning in this particular position. Number three, this is really a question for the boroughs, or anyone else. Are you all satisfied that the matters that are in the construction method statement are all covered in the code of construction practice? Because that was a concern as to whether this should be a certified document. The answer came back, well, it doesn't need to be, because everything that is in it is otherwise governed. If no one else is concerned over this point, I think it's unlikely that it would be one that we would want to pursue. Yep. Sorry, the sun's in my eyes. Is that
Thank you,
Newham
Robin Whitehouse, London Borough of Newham. We have some concerns in that the Code of Construction Practice is still open to negotiation, and we feel there's quite a lot of work to be done on that document. And as such, to say that the CMS... everything's included that needs to be. It may well be now, but obviously an error could be made. The other issue is the CMS does contain quite a number of statements that aren't actually construction related. So, you know, rights of access for... I mean, they're associated with the construction, rights of access for ASD metals, for example. And to be honest, at this point, I'm not entirely certain whether they're all covered off in the Code of Construction Practice. So, and also there's commitments within the CMS also with regards to any changes in method statement and how that would be not environmentally worse than the assessed scheme. So there's a little bit of work there to do just to make sure whether that they are all genuinely covered.
When we get to requirement five, some of those points about what is or is not currently in the Code of Construction Practice, I think we'll be wanting to pursue. But would your point be satisfied that if, after further scrutiny, it is discovered that there are salient points that are in the construction method statement that haven't been brought through to the Code of Construction Practice that are important safeguards, those presumably should be put in, and then we could have just the one document certified? But at the moment, you're saying you're not convinced that all salient matters have been carried across.
That's correct.
Well, presumably, as you say, the Code of Construction Practice is still being discussed. You will make sure that these points are flagged up.
Yes, I will. Thank you.
And
Kim Smith, Greenwich, just to concur with Robin, for the sake of completeness and to be able to fully understand the full impacts of the construction, we'd currently think the CMS should be defined, but if we can incorporate that into the COCP by final draft, that's fine.
And it would go along with your desire to have the minimum number of documents.
It absolutely would, sir.
Thank you. Do you need to come back on that one, Mr. Owen?
Just to say, we're very happy to listen to any suggestions made about what should go into the CSCP.
Well, then, number four, this is where we got to, I think, with the Environment Agency before lunch, that there is the issue of some of these disapplications aren't acceptable at the moment until you've resolved the issue of the river walls in particular.
Laura Stevenson for the Environment Agency. Sorry, my colleague Carol Bolt has just had to step outside. Yes, you're right, sir. The main issue is that we cannot agree to any disapplication of legislation until we're satisfied that we've got suitable protective provisions. As you heard prior to lunch, we are in discussions with Transport for London and hope to get a document to you by deadline 3 outlining the direction of our discussions and what issues are remaining.
Thank you very much. I think the next one was your point about the control buildings.
Right, yes. So the next part of this agenda item, the second paragraph in 4, Lillian Harrison, one of the examining inspectors, by the way. Given the answer that we received to one of our first written questions, we're asking whether the provision sought in Article 3.2 about the disapplication of the SIL regs, can that be justified on the basis that there will be operational staff based in the tunnel services compound who will need to deal with emergencies. So in a normal planning application, that kind of development, as I understand it, would normally be covered by SIL charges. So it's a question, firstly, to the host authorities. So I think the main host authority there would be Newham, where the buildings would be situated. And then maybe we can find out from the applicant why they want to do this. Thank you.
James Burton, London Borough of Newham. This was discussed in a meeting with TfL last Friday, and we have some advice coming from them. So if you don't mind, madam, I would like to wait and see when we've got that to see if we'll progress that point further.
Thank you. Can we ask Mr. Owen if there's an update on that?
Robbie Owen, not that I'm aware, madam, no. I think the point here is the appropriateness of, if this provision were to be removed, of subjecting an infrastructure scheme or requiring an infrastructure scheme, namely this tunnel, to pay for other infrastructure just seems to us to be entirely inappropriate. And therefore, even though it is the case that some operational staff will be based in the services compound to deal with emergencies, we say that doesn't negate the point of policy, if you like, as to why it would be rather bizarre, we would say, for this project to be subject to SIL.
Thank you.
Could we ask Newham if they've got any other examples of infrastructure projects that have attracted SIL charges in the past?
I couldn't comment on that, madam.
Thank you. Okay.
Well, we await to hear the outcome of further
consideration or negotiations, but we've taken note of the applicant's position.
Excuse me, sir. I've just had whispered in my ear, London City Airport, as an example.
London City Airport paid you SIL contributions, is that right?
Yes, so I you know, we're back to probably the whether the chalk and cheese sort of a bit between Highways England and London City Airport. I think London City Airport is probably rather more permanently occupied and intensively occupied than this building is likely to be.
Robbie Owen, so I could also indicate that this is not a provision we've completely made up from scratch. It is precedented, and we feel it's appropriate to draw on that in this case. We can refer you to the Thames Tubby Tunnel Development Consent Order that has a very similar provision in. That, of course, authorised a rather large infrastructure project.
Thank you very much. That's helpful. We move then on to the question of the word adjacent. Now, this is one where those that advise us feel that there is a lack of certainty as to... You have, I think, explained in writing in answers to questions what you understand by the meaning of the word adjacent, but it does seem to be a term that is... not particularly well defined in the order, if it's defined in a sense at all. And I will invite further comment on that point.
Robbie Owen, Transport for London. We have given this further consideration in the light of the panel's comments and indeed comments from some interested parties. The result is that we are intending to amend the draft DCO at deadline 3 to provide that this provision applies to land that is directly adjacent to the order limits, i.e. has a common boundary, which we hope deals with the perceived uncertainty here.
Yes, I think the only thing that wouldn't deal with is, I suppose, you might say the River Thames or something. It would have a common boundary, but it stretched for 200 miles. But, I say that slightly tongue-in-cheek, but, I mean, there may be other really linear pieces of land that stretch away from the order lands, but I'll leave that point with you. Well, we then, on Article 5... We
so
do
sorry,
get,
sir.
Sorry.
I'm so sorry. Alison Gorlov, Port of London Authority. You, what you said just now, with which the PLA are wholly in agreement with the panel here, you said slightly tongue-in-cheek, didn't quite put it in these terms, but you were really asking Mr. Owen what was the perceived outer boundary, if there was a common boundary that was shared. And although you may have said it's slightly tongue-in-cheek, sir, the PLA don't. It does... have a real effect. We noted that in the response they gave, TfL explained the nature of the legislation that they were trying to capture here, and one understands that and has no quarrel with it. The only thing is the words don't say that, and so they would pick up, and the PLA's interest is primary in the Port of London Act 1968 and the other legislation under which it operates. This is saying that that potentially doesn't operate for the whole length of the River Thames, which is unhelpful. It's not what's meant. It's not the way it's intended to work. Mr. Owen, no doubt, would say, well, this stuff isn't inconsistent with his order, but we don't want to have to go down the road of having even to analyse it. And it's not always an easy question to answer. So we would say, sir, they still haven't got it quite right on the basis of the formulation that Mr. Owen has just told us.
Thank you.
If I might add, perhaps they would consider further.
I'm sure you will be considering the point further. But
sir, I will be considering the point further.
Well, we now move to Article 5, which I think is probably, as far as the panel is concerned, one of the biggest concerns, this question of the horizontal limit of deviation.
I think we've had the explanation about how the different varieties of compulsory acquisition of rights and temporary possessions sort of define where the scheme is, but and obviously there is requirement for which does say citing in it, but again it's down to the question of what is the citing being judged against. It would seem to us that of the various suggestions, comments in the agenda, agreeing a limit of lateral deviation from the centre lines or the boundaries of the individual works, they wouldn't need to be shown on a plan if they were simply referred to as a certain dimension, would resolve this issue, that it would still allow for some flexibility, as is typical in these kind of orders, but would actually provide some rather more specific limitation that did relate to what has been assessed in the environmental statement.
Robbie Owen, we've given this further consideration, and we do recognise the issues the panel has raised here, and I think all I can say today is that we are giving active consideration to how we can do better, if I can put it that way. And I think the suggestion you have made in the question, in terms of using perhaps words in the order with reference to a distance, is that's a helpful suggestion, and we think there may be something in that, possibly combined with showing something on possibly some of the sections in terms of centre lines. So we're working hard to be able to set out our position on this at deadline 3. And we hope the result will be that you will feel more comfortable that the lateral limits are more constrained than at the moment, even though, as you've explained, given the way all the plans and powers interrelate in practice, there is a constraint already. But we do understand the concern. We wanted to assure you of that. It is complex, as I think is appreciated by all concerned. So if I could ask that we could be left to it, and we will come up with our solution, we hope, for deadline 3.
That's fine. I think the subsequent paragraph is a point that the PLA had highlighted, that there is a minor inconsistency, which I don't think, in a sense, we need to pursue here, but one would assume that inconsistency can be resolved one way or the other. If there is, it is not clear exactly what the point is, I'm sure it can be transmitted.
All I was going to say, sir, Alison Gall of PLA, I don't know that the inconsistency in itself has been resolved or will be resolved. However, a formulation has been reached, the words are being agreed, and they will define the depth of the channel, so we won't really terribly bother about anything that's underneath it. If the channel's the right depth, the PLA is content.
Yes, though if there is an inconsistency, it would still be desirable to eliminate it, even if you've solved the problem in a different way.
Well, sir, I don't think it matters terribly, because what the PLA were worried about was that the cover wasn't right in terms of the words and they'd pop up through the riverbed. If the channel has to be a particular depth, they won't be able to. So it doesn't actually matter. It'll be self-correcting, if you see what I mean.
I see what you mean, but it might be better to eliminate anything from the order that implied that otherwise, but... Anyway, I can perhaps, you've got further discussions to go on, and perhaps this matter can be resolved. Article 25.8.
Sorry, could I raise a point about Article 14 at this
point?
Well,
yes, that is consistent with the agenda.
Is that
I say
okay?
If people have got points in between these, do raise
them.
Sorry,
I was a bit slow to the mark there. I'm Karis Evans on behalf of Thames Water. We've
which article are we?
Article 14.
14.
Thames have objected to the deemed consent provisions as they relate to Article 14 discharges, which relates to water discharges in connection with the construction and maintenance of the authorised development. It discharges into watercourses and sewers and drains, but obviously we're only concerned with the sewers and drains aspect. Under Article 14, the applicant needs consent to discharge, and Thames Water or the owner of the sewer or drain can impose conditions on those discharges. We've objected to the deemed consent provision and have asked for it to be replaced with deemed refusal. We just wanted to sort of clarify a couple of our arguments in the written representations and just to respond to the applicant's comments on our written representations. Hopefully I won't take too long. For us, I suppose deemed consent means unconditioned discharges, which equal uncontrolled discharges. From our perspective, we need conditions and control on the discharges because the sewage system isn't necessarily designed to convey or treat the anticipated discharges from the tunnel, which are, well, we anticipate sort of groundwater from tunnel dewatering, significant amounts of water that the sewage system isn't necessarily designed to accommodate. And also, there isn't any basis to charge for the service that we are providing other than by condition. Uncontrolled discharges of this nature are a significant risk to various things and could create significant criminal and civil liabilities for Thames Water as a company. The risks, which we've gone into in our written representations anyway, but I'll just summarise here, are things like flooding of customers' homes. So if you put too much water into a sewer at a pinch point that doesn't have capacity to deal with it, it can back up upstream, flood into customers' homes. It could cause us to be in breach of our statutory duties, which are to effectually drain an area. And obviously if our sewer capacity has been taken over by something else, then we might not be able to achieve that duty. It could cause us to breach our environmental permits. We have permits on our sewage treatment sites with quite stringent conditions on them. And obviously, if something like contaminated groundwater is put into the system and the sewage treatment works isn't necessarily designed to treat that before it goes back into the environment, could cause us to breach our permits. It could cause flooding and pollution of the environment, so things like discharges from sewage treatment works for water that hasn't been treated properly, or possibly flooding from the network through manholes and various things like that could cause pollution to the environment. The consequences for Thames of these risks are that obviously Ofwat can fine us up to 10% of turnover for breach of statutory duty, and also we could face prosecution for flooding and pollution. The recent sentencing guidelines for environmental offences mean that for a company of Thames' size, which is a turnover of over 50 million or more, the fines could be between sort of 7,000 and 3 million, depending on culpability and harm. Although it's not sort of in the explanatory memorandum, we understand from speaking to the applicant that their concern and the reason why they've put in deemed consent is that that there's no sort of trigger point in Article 14 for decisions to be made. Sorry, I'm talking about Article 14. The original revision one, version one of the DCO had the deemed consent provision in Article 14, and that's now been taken out and moved into Article 68. Beginning. Sorry. We understand that that's the reason for putting in deemed consent, because there is no trigger point. So essentially, a decision maker could receive an application and then not do anything with it, and there would be nothing that the applicant could do about that. Article 14 does include a right to refer disputes as if they were Section 106 disputes, or Section 106 of the Water Industry Act. And under Section 106, you can refer a refusal of consent to Ofwat, essentially. What we've proposed in our written representations is that we replace deemed consent with deemed refusal. And the result, hopefully, would then be that the applicant, if they don't get a response within a specified period of time, they will have a means of taking it further and it should solve the concern with delay, and it should give the obviously the decision maker the motivation to deal with the application. And then, from our perspective, that removes the risk of the uncontrolled discharge.
But if I can understand you, because we're talking about the deemed consent being in Article 68,
yep.
And that is referring to any provision in Part 2, I think, of the order. We've already had it explained that it doesn't refer to requirements or protective provisions. If you simply change Article 68 to deemed refusal, then I don't know what other things necessarily, without checking back through the order, you might be applying to. Or are
it
you
will,
suggesting
it
that
will,
you...
It will apply to lots of things because...
Are you suggesting that instead time limits are put into Article 14?
Yeah, I think,
And a deemed refusal then put into Article 14?
That would be our solution.
And it's excluded from Article 68?
Yeah, what we would like is for just the sewer and drain owner reference in Article 68 to be removed, so that we come out of that, and then for deemed, as you say, deemed refusal to be put into Article 14, with currently it's 28 days. We're not sure that that is long enough to deal with the type of discharges that are anticipated here, but we think that would be a good solution for this concern.
Well, I don't know whether you want to come back now or have further discussions and negotiations with Thames Water.
So I'd like to do both, actually.
Okay.
Yes, discussions will continue. It's important to recognise that we're dealing here with a nationally significant infrastructure project. It's important that subsidiary consents and approvals are not delayed. That's a well-established principle. This provision... albeit the drafting is now in Article 68, not peppered around the rest of the order, but the principle is well understood in terms of having deemed approvals. We haven't made this up ourselves. I could cite quite a few DCOs, let alone other statutory orders, where this is in them. So we think it's a fair starting point and a fair position for us to be establishing. But all that said, we will... see if we can find some compromise ground with Thames Water.
Could I just say one other thing? Sorry. We appreciate that obviously deemed consent has made its way into a number of DCOs over the last couple of years. We don't deny that that's happened. It certainly wasn't in the model provisions. It's something that seems to have... crept in, but deemed refusal was included in the Thames Tideway Tunnel Order, which was obviously a tunnelling operation where you might see similar types of discharges, dewatering from tunnelling or contaminated water from tunnelling. And obviously the Thames Tideway Tunnel Order was something that we applied for, but we still appreciated the significant risks that were involved in deemed consent and put in deemed refusal in that particular case. So although there are many more orders out there that have deemed consent in there, we think from our perspective, at least historically, we've applied it to ourselves and we would like, because of the risks, to apply it. We think it's proportionate. It deals with hopefully the article's concern and the applicant's concerns, and then it also protects us from the significant risks that could come of deemed consent.
Well, let's hope that the discussions produce a way forward on this. Articles 29 and 30, the different provisions about temporary possession, what we were given an explanation as to why it wasn't necessary to give a purpose, but we find it difficult to see why for construction there is one approach and for maintenance there is the other approach, and perhaps ask that further reflection might be given on that as to why there can't be a consistent treatment of giving a purpose for the temporary possession, because if you don't have a purpose, it is not terribly clear when the time periods for giving it up and the like would apply. But
So did you mean, Robbie Owen here, TFL, did you mean to miss out item 7?
Ah, I didn't mean to miss it out. Thank you for drawing that to my attention. Thank you.
Shall I deal with that first?
Yes.
Item 7 is Article 25.8, and the question was, what is the justification for omitting the time limit for making a vesting declaration? 25.8 simply applies the Vesting Declarations Act of 1981 so that it is consistent with the five-year period under which compulsory acquisition powers under the DCO can be exercised. The normal period for GVDs to be executed is 3 years of the relevant compulsory purchase order having been confirmed and becoming operative, and that's clearly inconsistent with the provisions of this order. In Article 21, Paragraph 1, we have the usual for projects of national significance and of this size and nature, the usual five-year period with which to exercise the powers of compulsory purchase, or compulsory acquisition. And therefore, that is the justification, sir, in terms of omitting the normal three-year limit for making a GBD, because the limit proposed as per Article 21 is 5 years.
Okay. Thank you very much. That's very helpful. So then we can move then into the item 8, the consistency between giving a purpose for temporary possession, whether it's for construction or maintenance. Mr. Owen?
Robbie Owen, Transport for London. We do see a distinction here, sir, between Article 29, which deals with the temporary use of land for carrying out the authorised development, so constructing the initial scheme, and Article 30, which confers a power of temporary use of land for maintaining an aspect of the scheme. And under Article 30, possession is required for a particular purpose relating to maintenance of the project within the five-year period, because this only applies to the five-year period after the scheme's first been opened. So if possession is intended in that period, then at least 28 days in advance under paragraph 5 of Article 30, TFL has to serve notice of the intended entry on the owners and occupiers of the land concerned, and that notice has to contain the purpose for which TFL intends to take possession of the land, and that the way in which Article 30, paragraph 5 now reads was amended by the applicant to deadline 1 to provide that very point that the purpose for temporary occupation in the context of maintenance had to be specified in the notice given to occupiers, and we recognise that point. And whilst the provision in the precedents didn't include that provision for the purpose, we thought it was a fair point. And the reason we did was that under Article 30, paragraph 6, TFL is only allowed to remain in possession of the land under that article for as long as is reasonably necessary to carry out the maintenance of the part of the scheme concerned for which possession was taken. So that is a perfectly understandable sort of regime and justifiable regime we feel for maintenance, whereas for the initial construction it's a rather more sort of complex set of circumstances, as you might understand. In Article 29 relating to temporary possession for initial construction operates differently in terms of the length of occupation. This refers, as is indeed standard in these provisions, as you may be aware, to a period of occupation following basically you can stay in occupation until a year after completion of the development. And that's as distinct from under Article 30, where you can stay, as I've just said, in occupation for as long as it's reasonably necessary to do what you've taken entry to do. So it's the difference in drafting of Article 29 and 30 is a reflection of the very different circumstances in which temporary possession is proposed to be taken for initial construction under Article 29 as opposed to for particular selected maintenance works in Article 30. And we say that that is why, in accordance with the precedents, but we've also sort of gone a bit further, as I explained, that those two articles are drafted differently.
Thank you very much. Anything? Right, thank you.
James Burton, London Borough of Newham. I just want to raise the fact that Article 29, the Council has some concerns with the way that it's currently written, in that the Northern Portal site within the London Borough has some very environmentally sensitive land uses. There's concrete batching and waste transfer and these sorts of things. This particular article during the construction phase would in our opinion, allow uses to continue while construction's going on, and that's not necessarily captured in the ES. Discussions we've had with TFL indicate that that's not the intention of this article and that eventually it will be refined, but I want to flag up that we have concern that article does currently allow that in our view.
Can you...
We recognise that from your deadline 2 representation. So we would be grateful if you could update us on your discussions. It would be helpful if the applicant could give us an update on whether that was meant to be the intention of the way that this article's worded at the moment.
Robbie Owen, Transport for London. My understanding from what Mr. Burton said in a meeting that took place last Friday is that this concern relates to the provision of Article 29.1e that says that TfL may, in connection with the carrying out of the authorised development, provide any temporary facilities or works on the land set out in Schedule 7 for the benefit of landowners or occupiers temporarily displaced as a result of carrying out the scheme. So it is saying that in addition to the other purposes for which land can be occupied temporarily, a final purpose is in order to provide temporary facilities and temporary works for landowners and occupiers who have been temporarily displaced from somewhere else. Discussions with key landowners and occupiers concerned are continuing, as you'll be aware, and it is our intention to bring forward as soon as we can some changes to that provision of Article 29 I've just referred to narrow it down. We understand the concerns that London Borough of Newham have expressed to us, and we're working to conclude those discussions with the landowners and occupiers' concerns, so we can then be more specific in this provision as to which landowners and occupiers we're referring to. So I hope that assists.
Yes, I mean, I think it was mentioned that on the site that might be displaced or affected are things like waste transfer stations and a concrete batching plant. Those obviously provide services for the locality. I assume that Newham are not saying that they necessarily want those facilities closed down, as opposed to just being concerned where they may be relocated if they have to be relocated.
excuse me, that's correct. There is, I guess there's an unknown there if some of these uses were to continue concurrently with the construction of the tunnel about things like lorry movements and elements that may be outside of what's assessed in the ES.
Yes, so the ES would presumably be considering what is additional to what may be there at the moment. I suppose it could have been netted off if there was a a definite view that they had to go. But okay, thank you very much. Article 58, we come to the...
Sorry to detain
sir,
you.
Sir, could I...
So you may have to take lowest bids on which provision comes next.
No, I think it is the river parts, which we probably haven't covered, yes.
Thank you very much, sir. Sorry to detain you. The PLA... is not happy with what Mr. Owen has just told us. With respect to Mr. Owen and TfL, we don't think this is quite right. There are two categories of land of which temporary possession may be taken. The first category is the Schedule 7 land, of which only temporary possession may be taken. There, the DCO does indeed specify in Schedule 7 the purposes for which each bit of land is being taken. So the landowner who knows which work he's got to keep an eye on and when the 1 year will run out. However, paragraph, it's 29(1)(a)(2) is a power for Transport for London to take temporary possession of any land within the order limits, land that they haven't acquired. And that's what is of concern to the PLA. Such land may be used temporarily for the purposes of the works. Now, Mr. Owen may say that in the case of the river, which is all I'm talking about, it can only be work number one, but I'm a bit of a cynic. Who knows? It might actually not be. We have been told, the PLA, that there are limitations on what TfL proposes to do in the river. It's very welcome news, and we're working out words which will give effect to that. However, it is known that TfL will want to do things in the river other than in Schedule 7 land, and they may have to do so. If that happens, never mind any other landowner, the PLA needs to know what is the work to which that temporary possession relates. The very point you've made will kick in those circumstances. It won't be evident necessarily what is the work that's that is in point here and when the 1 year runs out. So I don't think Mr. Owen has answered that point, and the PLA respectfully agrees with the point that the panel has made, that this should be defined in the case only of 29(1)(a)(2) land.
So let me touch on this one, and this provision in 29(1)(a)(1) and 2 is based on the formulation that was put forward in relation to the Thames Tideway Tunnel, which identifies certain areas of land which can only be taken for temporary possession, and then secondly, other areas of land where there would normally be compulsory acquisition or compulsory rights taken, but you can go in advance and take temporary possession. There are reasons for that, which I can explain if you want to, but I'll put that to one side at the moment. As Ms. Goloff correctly points out, for the 29(1)(a)(1) land, the purpose is set out in Schedule 7 in Column 3. For the 29(1)(a)(2) land, there you're going on to land for which you have a power of compulsory acquisition. In other words, you will have had to have justified why you need that land in your statement of reasons and so on. And that is the purpose for which you can occupy the land. And you can see this in relation to the corresponding provision, which is 29(5), which is tells you when you have to get out. In respect of paragraph, so 29.5 says, in respect of any land specified in 1A1, i.e. the Schedule 7 land, you have to get out after the end of the period of 1 year beginning with the date of completion of the part of the authorised development specified in relation to that land in column 4 of Schedule 7. And in respect, and then this is the second case that Ms. Goloff is referring to, in case the land in 1A Roman 2, after the end of the period of 1 year beginning with the date of completion of the work for which temporary possession of the land is taken, unless TfL has by the end of that period served a notice. Mm. And so it's quite clear, A, there is a provision that tells you when you have to get out, but it's also quite clear that the period runs from the end of the date of completion of the work for which temporary possession is taken, and temporary possession is taken for the purpose for which the land would otherwise be compulsorily acquired. The reason for doing this, sir, is relates to proportionality. It may be that when the detailed work is done, it's decided that we can permanently acquire slightly less than is needed. That can't be determined at the moment, but if detailed design mean you could permanently acquire slightly less, what you would do is take possession temporarily in order to be able to go on and construct the works. When you know the precise position of the works, you would then only serve either the notice to treat or exercise the general vesting declaration into that bit of the land that you permanently needed. The important point in 29.5 is the period within which you have to get out is specified, and that was debated a lot at the Thames Tideway Tunnel, very similar sort of project, another tunnel next to the Thames, and that was basically the provision which the Secretary of State thought appropriate.
Thank you very much, Mr. Humphries. That's very helpful. What occurs to me, though, is that in 29.5b, it doesn't actually say that the purpose for which the land was temporary possession taken is the same as the purpose for which it might have been compulsorily acquired. I could envisage circumstances in which you were wanting to do just a temporary matter on it and then might ultimately never decide to take up the compulsory acquisition.
So that's absolutely right. Indeed, that is in a sense the point of the provision, because there could be exactly that, a circumstance where one has identified the land for compulsory acquisition because one needs to do a certain work on there. When the work is actually performed, you find a small edge of land at the side of it which you think, well, actually, I don't now permanently need this. This could go back to the landowner. So you would temporarily occupy it, you would carry out the work, and then you would acquire just so much you need, and that would allow you to give back the other land rather than having to acquire the entire lot in order to go on and do the work. And then having taken land from a landowner that you didn't ultimately need. As I say, that form, which I think first came...
So I was going to just add, Robbie Owen, that this form is now quite well established. It first arose through TWA orders at the turn of the about 2000, 2001, and there are now quite a lot of examples of what you now see in 29.5 in exactly that form. I think, so far as the PLA is concerned, however, this is perhaps a bit academic in a way, because the discussions we're having with the Port of London Authority have made it quite clear that the proposed protective provisions for the PLA would allow them to control not only the design and construction of works in the river, but also powers such as this of temporary occupation, and therefore we are. I should add, with reference to what was said on Tuesday, that TfL has never said and never intended to do anything like sever the river which is perhaps a rather emotive talk. That's never been the intention, or we would say the effect of the order, but be that as it may, certainly we've proposed wording to TfL to make it, to the PLA, to make it very clear that powers such as this of Article 29 would be subject to the full approval process of the protective provisions. So this is making sure that TfL has the core power of temporary possession of land, including the river, but it's then subject to the various safeguards that are proposed, particularly the protective provisions in favour of the Port of London Authority.
Thank you very much indeed, Mr. Rand. I certainly wasn't intending to query the drafting of 29.5. I think if I'm understanding the PLA's concern, if they still have one, it's still that if 29.1.2 applies, then in that circumstance a reason should be given for the...
For the purpose for which you could acquire an interest in land or something.
The purpose.
Your point, sir, is should Roman B say that you can enter on land for purpose for which the land could be acquired under article whichever one it is?
No, I say I'm not suggesting any change to 29.5B, which
seems completely 29.1AB. So you can enter on and take temporary possession of any land in the order in respect of which no notice to treat has been served. I thought your point was for a purpose for which the land could be acquired under
that wasn't my purpose.
I
think you have said that that is the purpose that you could enter into it.
Yes, the
order doesn't actually say that. And what I was suggesting was that if you are entering into land that is subject to that particular part of the order, then you should give a reason for why you are wanting to enter it.
I wonder if I might come in here, sir, because I think Mr. Humphries has possibly misled himself a little bit. The issue is not that that TfL would come on this land for the purpose of constructing a work. They're going to be burrowing under the river to construct their tunnel, but that's not what the PLA is worried about. The fact is that the river, the strip across the river, is within the order limits. And if they want to come on the river, they'll come onto the wet bit, not the bit where they're burrowing their tunnel. So the concern here is not with using the river for the purposes for which a little bit of it might be acquired. It's for the purpose of coming onto the surface of the river for a reason. And there will be very limited reasons, and we're very happy to be told that, and we will find the words that will define that. However, even in those limited circumstances, what the PLA is looking for, and it is just very few words, is for the notice in respect of this land, the A2, the 29.1A2 land, to be told which is the work for which the land is being used. It will not obviously be, for example, work number one, which is what goes underneath the riverbed. It could conceivably be one or two other works adjoining the river where, for some reason, TfL find they need to put something on the water in order to carry out those works. So now, it is absolutely right that all this is very much, it's a lesser point than perhaps it's sounding, because Mr. Owen is absolutely right that the PLA will have the ability to approve the carrying out, the exercise of this power. But there is a difference between approving that which is put to you, which you have to do on a reasonable basis, on the one hand, and there being a limitation on what may be put to you in the first place. If TfL come to the PLA with a proposal to use a bit of the river, not the whole river, a bit of the river, for purpose X, for period Y, and we think period Y is actually longer than it needs to be, it is very much more difficult for the PLA to impose that condition. They've got an extra hurdle to overcome if they are not told how long is the maximum period for which TfL are entitled to remain on that land. They can't simply dictate to TfL, and they don't want to do so. TfL's entitlement under the order will have a bearing on the reasonableness of the conditions that the PLA is able to impose. And all we want is a tiny little bit of transparency, and we actually find it a little difficult to understand what's the PLA's problem. I will say just one other thing, if I might. Mr. Owen is very keen on precedents. TTT, is at Thames Tideway, is definitely a precedent which says something different. But I think that what the panel should bear in mind, sir, is that in that case, there was one main work, and therefore it was pretty obvious what the work was which would be affecting the river. Here, it is slightly less obvious.
Well, thank you very much for that. I think I understand what the concern is there. I think the point that the panel might wish to reflect on is whether it is exclusively a PLA concern, which I think Mr. Owen was saying protective provisions might otherwise deal with in any event. I think the way we were looking at it was that we could conceive of probably circumstances on land and not just on water where this point might arise. But Mr. Owen.
So it may assist for me to say this, that we would be happy, I'm sure, to give considerations to the addition of just a few words to 29.4, which obliges notice to be given before entry, just to say in serving notice, TfL, which is perfectly reasonable, has to say what the purpose of the temporary possession would be, and that would apply whether it was water or land covered by water or dry land. And in effect, the notice would say which of the purposes for which temporary possession can be taken under the list B, C, D, and E of paragraph 1 was a relevant purpose, or if more than one of them, yeah, which one. So
we've possibly come full circle to where we started, but certainly that would, I think, certainly meet our concerns with that. And you know,
we might have done perhaps a semicircle, but yes, perhaps that's the solution that we're taking that away. But also we are continuing, as you know, we will probably hear more about this shortly, to continue our discussions with the PLA on their own issues.
Thank you very much. I don't know whether that necessarily means that we have to look at the second half of item 8 about these other issues to do that the PLA had raised in particular, or whether that is all being dealt with or has already been dealt with in terms of ongoing discussions.
I think so. We really ought to deal with it. It is quite important. Sorry, Alison Gwall of Port of London Authority. You've asked how these articles maintain all rights of navigation on the river. Well, the fact is they don't. The wording, as presently worded, both Article 29 and Article 30 say that when possession is taken, the rights of navigation are suspended. Now, that's in 29.2 and 32. That means, as one reads the orders at the order at the moment, that this is automatic. That leaves the PLA asking, well, how is it going to work, I won't say on the ground, on the water? If you shut up a road, you put a barrier up there, say road diversion, or have a man with a waving his arms. But that doesn't quite work like that in a large piece of water. There has to be some machinery for keeping people out, and not just a little flotilla of boats. Then mariners need to know where they can and cannot go. There is such a machinery, and it is that the harbour master makes direction to vessels. He issues a notice to mariners and tells them that they can't go somewhere. TfL may not have quite have appreciated that. We are talking to them about words which will provide for that in the order, so that there is a proper orderly machinery for making sure that when the rights of navigation are suspended over any water area, a notice is properly given and people know they have to keep away. And there is a means of enforcement. So that is the first thing that the panel perhaps needs to know. You've asked about mooring buoys. That's the next item on this.
The mooring buoys we think are in point here are the Victoria Barge Road mooring buoys. These are some moorings which are owned by the PLA. They're very large moorings. They will interfere with the works, and one of the set of them will interfere permanently with the tunnel, therefore it has to go permanently and be relocated somewhere, and the other has to move temporarily. There are probably other buoys in the river, but those are the ones we immediately know about. They're in the work number 20 box, if I can call it that area, if that. Yes, they do have to be moved. The order, I think, contemplates that the PLA will move them, and if you look at the protective provisions, says that they will be reimbursed for the cost. They're PLA-owned moorings, so that is not a problem. But the panel is quite right that TfL has got power to move moorings. That's in its ancillary powers. I think it's in Schedule 1. It's the list of ancillary development, paragraph little I. So they've got power to move moorings that they find. In fact, they won't want to move these ones. They'll want us to do it, I dare say. But they haven't got power to relocate outside the order limits. So that answers, I think, your second point. But it will be dealt with because the agreement has been reached with the PLA on that. I think actually that probably deals with what you wanted to know.
If you've reached agreement and that will be covered in the protective provisions, then that seems to resolve the matter, I think, then.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Do I see? Yes, I do see.
So, yes, it was merely to interject some comments on Articles 43 and 56 before you reached 58. I don't know whether now is the appropriate time to do that.
I think now is the appropriate time. I'm looking at the clock and wondering about a break, but ideally I would probably like to take the break before we move on to schedules, if we could get to the end of the article. So I see a number have come up now there.
I'll be succinct, bearing in mind the time and the need to press on. So firstly, on Article 43, this is about closing the tunnels, and we are here concerned with non-emergency closures of the tunnels. And it's a very short point. Essentially, 43.2 requires that TfL, if they are proposing to close either or both of the tunnels, they must accept in an emergency, give not less than 7 days' notice. And at the moment, there's no provision for to whom that notice ought to be given. And we say that that ought to be specified. The applicant's response to this within its TfL reference 8.27 and page 161 of that document was that, well, they would follow broadly the same procedures as they normally do for planned closures of the Blackwall, which is, i.e. giving notice to all London boroughs. We say, well, if that's what they're planning on doing, they should make good on that commitment, and it ought to be included. I mean, I don't say that they should be mandated to do things. It may be that some wording in terms of where reasonably practicable or something like that, but simply being required to give notice, in our view, bears to be improved upon a little bit by specifying to whom. The second article I'd just like to comment briefly on is 56, and this is the application of charges levied. And it's a very similar point in terms of, well, we have said in the past that there either ought to be a cascade of priorities in terms of where the funding ought to be applied to, or in any event, the TfL's general fund ought not to be given the same priority as all of the others, A to D above it. And the answer, again, given by TfL, and this is in document 8.26 in the answers to the examining authority's written questions, it's page 81 of that document, table 3-24. And the response was, well, where we've got a surplus, we'll apply the funds to the general fund. And so I make the same point I made in 43. Well, great, but could we have that in the DCO, please? Could they make good on that? And I see no reason, if that's the intention, oh, well, we'll only put the funding into our general fund where
it doesn't fall to be applied into any of the other categories, well, I see no reason so why that can't be replicated in Article 56. Thank you.
Sorry, can I just clarify where replicated from where?
So the TFL have said, in answer to our point, it ought to be in it. In summary, it is, well, don't worry,
what,
we'll
in
only...
In other words, put what they've put to you already as an answer in the order.
Yes, so yes, exactly that. So the answer was sort of, trust us, we'll only apply it to our general fund when we've got a surplus, and, well, fine, but in my submission that ought to be a commitment in the order itself.
So you're not trying to get it applied to... extending the overground to Lewisham or
well, on behalf of the number of Southwark, no.
Southwark, yes, it's Lewisham next door.
I appreciate that it's probably out with the scope of your powers to direct, yes, where TFL ought to be applying their funding.
Clearly, if there are surpluses going into the general fund, that presumably means more money available to consider doing other projects. But
that is absolutely the case. It is only just to make sure that spillover of monies into the general fund only happened where there was a surplus.
Why would that, in a sense, be a concern to Southwark? And it seems logical that they'd be needing to meet their direct expenses before they sent the money anywhere else. But you're wanting to ensure that their expenses are met first. But
well, it's part of it. It's not just that the expenses. There are, in terms of kind of applying funding to mitigation, maintenance, etc. We just wanted to make sure that it sort of seemed a good public policy principle, a good drafting principle, to have the general fund be last in the priority scale.
So it's particularly to make sure that D comes before A, then.
It is, yeah.
Okay. Shall we hear what Lewisham want to say before we move on to any response?
Thank you, sir. Alison Squires on behalf of the London Borough of Lewisham and the London Borough of Hackney. And there's just two brief points that we would like to make. Firstly, in relation to Article 52, and just to put forward Lewisham and Hackney's case that the user charge should be in perpetuity, be that within the article itself or within the charging policies and procedures. I know we've discussed that at some length a little bit this morning, but just to give the heads up that we'll be putting that into both boroughs' deadline-free submissions. And then secondly, in relation to Article 56, a similar point to London Borough of Southwark, in terms of we think that policy and that article should have a hierarchy. But in addition, an additional point that we've already put in our deadline two submissions for both boroughs is that we also think an additional point should be included in a higher hierarchy to that point E about that money being spent on a package of river crossings and improving sustainable transport in the areas affected by the Silvertown Tunnel. So not going into the specifics as we mentioned this morning in terms of DLR or other extensions, but just to make it clear that any surplus money should be first spent in that eastern area of London before it goes into the general fund, which our understanding is, from TfL's response to our previous comments on this can be spent in accordance with their business plan, which means it could be spent anywhere across London as opposed to the areas affected by the scheme. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you. And Greenwich.
Thank you. Kim Smith, Greenwich. Two points, one relating to Article 43 and one relating to Article 48, which may or may not be linked. We asked for the definition of emergency as part of the previous issue-specific hearing and as part of our deadline to submissions. And it was explained to us that an emergency was a clearly understood word. Article 2 goes on to define carriageway and building, but not emergency. Our view would be that this relates to the tunnel closing. In an emergency, TfL can close it without notice. We would really like the term emergency design, defined in this context, whether it's through referring to the TDSWG, the Design Working Group, the Blue Light Services, how that's done, we're quite relaxed about, but we think it's quite important that it is defined. The second point is Article 48, which is the change of the bylaws, and initially we questioned the need to change the bylaw for Blackwall Tunnel at the time that construction commenced, and being a nervous animal, a local authority, we were wondering if there was any connection between the change of the bylaw dates and the failure to define emergency. For example, if there was an emergency with the construction of Silvertown, would that constitute a reason to close Blackwall Tunnel? And it's how those could potentially be linked and what the potential impact could be for the local authority. But we don't think it's unreasonable to define emergency.
So if emergency is defined, you're not necessarily pressing any change to Article 48? 48,
that's absolutely correct. Yeah. We would just like emergency to be defined, please.
Mr. Owen, I think if you could come back on. I don't think there are any more.
James Burton, London Borough of Newham. My comment is in relation to 56, which is the application by TfL of charges levied on the screen at the moment. I'd just like to add that the London Borough of Newham would like to see mitigation of scheme impacts included in, I guess, the ways that TfL can spend their money from this scheme.
Is that being suggested as part of paragraph E, subparagraph E, which is where making payments into TfL's general fund, and it's been suggested that might be then required to be for a package of river crossroads and sustainable transport in East London. Are you saying for mitigation measures in the vicinity of the tunnel out of the general fund, or are you wanting that as a separate item of the general fund?
Murray Woodburn, London Borough of Newham. I think we were looking for it as a separate item to ensure that
the
schemes identified in the TIM strategy had their funding ring-fence from the funding gathered by the tunnel revenue.
So if one was looking for a hierarchy, either explicit or just by implication of the order of these items, you'd probably put that ahead of maintenance then?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure we would be particularly concerned, but I would expect it to appear at least at C, I think.
Well, C is the one that you've got to pay the operator, which I'd have thought...
I'm suggesting that if we go through planning, consenting, design and construction for the two tunnels, then the subsequent requirement for that revenue should be to ensure that any mitigations that are required as a result of the TIM strategy...
Well, in fact, you mean adding it into B, the one that talks about the expenses in managing...
Well, or a new C, or...
And providing mitigation for.
Hmm. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And yes, you. Okay.
Austin Smith, it's just a query or a question for Mr. Owen. In terms of the payments for the PPP, how is that actually going to be arranged in the sense that the revenue that is generated, will that go to the operator or the organisation running the whole PPP scheme? And then how is any surplus from that then dispersed? Is it a case that if they happen to make more money, they keep it?
Robbie Owen, shall I deal with that point and then, sir, the other points that have just been raised? On that point, the intention is that the revenue received from the user charge would go to TfL, would remain with TfL, and then TfL would use that to pay over the availability payments, which will be due to the project company under the project company agreement. The provision of Article 56C is just to allow TfL to spend money from the charge income insofar as it has to perform its side of the bargain in terms of what the project agreement will require TfL to do, as opposed to what the project agreement, which will be its main focus, of course, will be requiring the project company to do. So it's probably not correct to call it an accounting provision, but it's just to make sure that there's cover there for the amount of money that TfL will have to spend in terms of, for example, monitoring the project co, liaising with the project co on all the various interfaces which will remain.
Well, I mean, presumably it is under 56C that the payments would be made, the availability payments would be made.
That as well, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
The reason that I asked about the other points above that, surely those are wrapped up within those availability payments that cover for the maintenance and so on? Or is that out with whatever the company providing the availability is deemed to be required to do?
Well, there's perhaps some overlap there.
Is it overlap or duplication? I would have thought that in a PPP arrangement, you're paying for everything in one package.
I think so. It's probably a bit more complicated than that. I mean, there are lots of different types of PPP arrangements, and the obligations of the private sector company can vary from one scheme to another in terms of quite how much maintenance they're doing and operation, for example. And I think clearly here there's a complication of the fact that this tunnel and the Blackwell Tunnel will need to be operated together. And the intention, as I understand it, is that TfL will remain in charge of operating and maintaining Blackwell Tunnel. With Silvertown, the project co will be responsible for maintaining aspects of it, at least for the project company length of term. I think it's 20 years.
I think it's just that I think there needs to be some sort of clarification on all of this, because I think when Mr. Humphreys was discussing or giving us an overview of this, he described it as a design, build and maintain. And so I was assuming that the maintenance was wrapped up in that arrangement.
I think on the whole, the maintenance for the period of the agreement will be, but of course the agreement will come to an end after 20 years, and then TfL may well take maintenance back in-house of the Silvertown Tunnel, in which case it would need to have the authority to use the toll income, the charge income, to pay for that maintenance at that stage.
Would that be its intention?
So I can't indicate what might be the intention of TfL in over 20 years' time. I don't know, but we will give what clarification we can on 56 after this hearing at deadline 3. We will give consideration to whether it can be organised with reference to some sort of hierarchy. Mitigation, I would have thought, is already covered in A, in fact, because clearly the mitigation that is part of the scheme and secured by requirements and other mechanisms is an aspect of a cost and expense incurred in planning, consenting, designing, constructing the tunnel.
Mr. Owen, if I could make a small point on that, I think the issue is not the mitigation that's in the scheme, but it's the mitigation that isn't foreseen at the moment but may be required in order to bring the scheme back down to the assessed case, as we were discussing 2 days ago in relation to the trigger points in the TIMS report. So there may be mitigation required in areas that aren't currently foreseen, and they wouldn't possibly be covered in your long-term estimated costs, and I think that's where the local authorities were raising concerns.
That certainly was my understanding of the local authority, that it was the Thames mitigation, but essentially that we were...
Yes, well, sorry, if I could just clarify the point I was making. Yes, it is very much as the panel understands it. Clearly there is a large obligation in terms of administrative and monitoring costs in relation to STIG, and also the subsequent implementation of any mitigations that are identified by STIG, none of which have any reference in what the money is to be spent on. And I think it would make sense to include a reference to that whole process in that list. Thank you.
Could I ask another point? This occurred to me 2 days ago. It was about 7:30 at night after we had all this. And the question really is, in the economic appraisal, it was identified that there would be this substantial positive net present value emerging from it. And many of the benefits in that were attributable to the bus operation. I saw no evidence or information in what was provided as to whether those bus operations would be financially viable in their own right or would require some form of underlying subsidy to ensure that they could be provided. Is there a case for writing in to this section 56 or this part 56 some guaranteed or some arrangement for payment of a route tendering support mechanism for the bus services that have been specified in the scheme?
So I can only give a very general comment to that at this stage, you'll understand, but I think this is where it gets complex, because clearly Transport for London has a whole range of statutory functions and purposes. This tunnel, if authorised, will be added to to its collection, if you like, and the family of things that it does. And the regulation and commissioning and franchising and payment for bus services is a whole different subject. I think that it should be sufficient. I would say we've obviously got to have further discussions and possibly come back to another hearing in terms of in quite what form an obligation in relation to bus services might take, some sort of requirement. And I'd have thought that that should be sufficient, because it may well be that for all sorts of complex accounting reasons that Transport for London chooses to provide whatever subsidies may be necessary, and I don't know to what extent they will be necessary or not, chooses to provide those subsidies from a different pot. The financing and funding of TfL is clearly a complex subject. It's not something that I have any instructions on, and therefore I think the key thing is as long as the commitments that are agreed in relation to bus services through the tunnel are secured, and I'm sure they will be secured, then Transport for London will have an obligation to make sure that those commitments are complied with. And I think I would suggest that is the way to deal with this, rather than begin to, through this order, which is dealing with one particular piece of infrastructure, try to deal with / cut across all the existing funding arrangements that apply throughout Greater London in relation to the funding of bus services. Can I just come back to the point about...
Just on that point, though, there is a system already in operation for tendering in London, and there have been variants on that, whether net tendering or gross tendering. And there, it might be possible to provide some comfort to some of the interested parties if some reference was made to those arrangements within this DCO to enable them to have comfort or confidence that these things would actually be introduced.
So that might be for a revised bus strategy document, perhaps, rather than the provision. I'd find it rather hard to envisage it being in something like Article 56, but perhaps we can take that away and think about it further. And I understand the point about mitigation, and it may be that, and this is something that I think we would find it easier to envisage, that there could perhaps be a reference in 56 to whatever becomes of TIMS and the monitoring strategy and
the funding for STIG and TIMS.
Exactly.
I think that would seem to fit with the concern.
Yes, I mean, all I can say now is we will get that consideration, and I can see why that might make sense, but it's a complex issue which we need to give some further thought to.
And obviously you've heard the other suggestions about whether it is a firm hierarchy or and whether there should be any reference to the general fund being to be applied in East London. But you know, you heard all the requests that
are coming
through, and you will presumably consider them.
Yeah, we've got the shopping list, sir. Can I just quickly deal with the other points? I think the first was there were a number of points on Article 43. The lady from Southwark about to whom notice should be given. That is something that is perhaps a fair point, and we will consider to what extent we can provide in Article 43 for some words about that. Ms. Smith's point about emergency and defining emergency. Again, we think about it further. I'm not sure I've ever seen a definition of emergency in legislation, because by definition, an emergency is something that is one that you don't know about until it actually happens. I mean, you see emergency used in legislation a lot of orders of this nature. We will have a look, but I don't know it's ever been defined. But we can perhaps, in the right format, give an indication of the things that it could include. But some definitive definition, I think, would be harder. But we'll see what we can do. But I'm just playing out now. I can see it could be difficult. Then there was 48, but I think actually that wasn't a point, because I think Ms. Smith confirmed that if emergency was defined, then that went away. I think the remaining point is 52, charges being in perpetuity. I think our response to that would be, well, that is really an area for the role of the charging policy and procedures document. It is that governs the exercise of the order's functions in relation to charging, and as we heard this morning, requires TfL to ensure the project objectives are met. I think we would be likely to say that it would be inappropriate for the order itself to have a hard requirement for charging always to take place. We would have thought it's better to be dealt with through the charging policy and procedures document, which is more capable of reacting to changing circumstances with the input from STIG. I think so. That is all I think we can usually say at this stage.
I don't see anyone else wishing to come in at the moment, so I think that just leaves us before a break to look at Article 58 and the transfer of compulsory acquisition provisions. I think the concern that we've raised may be how you construe the word exclusive. Though it's slightly difficult for us to contemplate how you can transfer but not wholly transfer, if you so to mean, the CA provisions, but maybe that is what was intended. But our concern was that if you transferred sort of lock, stock and barrel, including the CA provisions, then the compensation issue still falls on someone else. And similarly, there is a compensation issue for temporary possession, and therefore does not that same issue arise in respect of that. So I think you know, our concern is in front of you, and interested to hear the response.
Robbie Owen, TfL. So I think I can deal with those two issues quite briefly. Taking them in reverse order, we understand the point about temporary possession and are happy to redraft this particular provision of the article to include temporary possession as well. so that the consenting mechanism would extend to that as well as compulsory acquisition functions. And secondly, the reference to exclusive transfer of any compulsory acquisition function was deliberate in that it is possible to transfer functions like those in this order to a PPP contractor so that they're exercised concurrently with TFL, but thinking it through further on receipt of the agenda item, we think that actually it's not necessary to refer to exclusive, because insofar as a compulsory acquisition function that is transferred to the private sector company is concerned, whether that function is also enjoyed concurrently with TFL or not, if the private sector contractor comes to exercise that function, then the compensation obligations would flow to the contractor, and therefore the concern you've expressed would apply, I think. So I think on reflection, the reference to exclusive transfer didn't really add anything, so we're happy to remove that.
Thank you very much. Well, I think that enables us to have a break. Should I... I'm trying to think. We're just after coming up to 25 past. Adjourn now until quarter to... Sorry.
Sorry, can I have a mic?
I just remembered in time. Bob Bennett, Tower Hamlets. I just wanted to get total clarification about 58. I think in your suggestion in the agenda, you made a reference, it's up there, about any transfer including CA functions. And I assume that would require the Secretary of State's consent. And I assume there you're making the assumption that all the powers we're talking about, in other words, all the TIMs and all that sort of stuff, is what we mean by
no,
functions.
No, this point arose from the concern that Transport for London, I won't say they've got unlimited financial resources, because they haven't got unlimited financial resources, but the resources that are available to the Mayor of London and their borrowing powers, etc., are such that one wouldn't normally query whether they had the power to compensate everyone that was being subject to compulsory acquisition and the compensation and injurious affection, all of that. But if they once transfer it to a contractor, that contractor can go broke, and therefore these obligations would not actually fall upon anyone, and people might have had their land taken and not get compensated. So that's what our concern was, and that's what the whole of this agenda item is really relating to. And the including was to get around the point about exclusive, and depending on how you construed the word exclusive. So I think Mr. Owen has answered our concern by just saying taking out the word exclusive. So if you are transferring the compulsory acquisition powers to someone else, whether concurrently or not concurrently, that consent would need to be obtained from the Secretary of State so that he can be satisfied that the body that would have those powers and might exercise those powers would have the resources to make any payments as a result. The point really isn't in relation to any other powers being transferred that we were making. You may have an issue about the transfer of powers, but that has been within the order from the outset, that are basically to do with this public-private partnership, this project company that is envisaged to actually undertake most of the works. And if without that power, that couldn't happen.
No, could I make... I mean, the point we did raise the concern in written representation in the first place. It's the transfer of all the other TFL functions in terms of, if you like, their statutory responsibilities in terms of dealing with the network and so on, which I assume would be included as the way this particular article is drafted. So all the charging policies and procedures, the TIMs and everything else we've been talking about, gets transferred to the private provider, if I'm reading this particular article correctly. If that is the case, then it's the question, how does that interrelate with TFL's other statutory functions? Bear in mind, some of this mitigation is taking place on
not in the tunnel, but in other TfL roads. It's just the interface between those two functions I'm not, just not clear about. Maybe I've got it wrong, but perhaps some clarity about
Mr.
it.
Mr. Owen to respond to...
Robbie Owen, Transport for London. TfL will have to negotiate the terms of the project agreement between itself and the public-private partnership entity that's going to be appointed to design in detail and construct and maintain the tunnel. And as part of that agreement, it will need to discuss and secure agreement as to which of the functions of TfL under this order, that is, which of the powers and duties under this order should be transferred to the Project Co. so that Project Co. can get on and do the job. Irrespective of that, it's quite clear from Article 58, Paragraph 4, which says that the exercise by any person under any such agreement of the functions conferred by or under this order or any other enactment is subject to the same restrictions, liabilities and obligations as would apply by or under this order as if those powers were exercised by a TfL. So the powers and duties transferred to the private sector company will be subject to the same restrictions and obligations as had they been retained by TfL and exercised by TfL. So that is the safeguard. And again, I should say that Article 58 is, there's nothing new in Article 58. It's a perfectly well-established mechanism for circumstances such as this. And you see Article 58.4 in many instances, and that's how, for example, many parts of the Docklands-Light Railway were constructed. They were authorised by Transport Works Act orders, very similar to development consent orders, and the powers were then transferred by TfL or Docklands-Light Railway Limited to the contractors concerned. So I don't know if that is of any comfort to Tower Hamlets, but that's certainly the position as we see it.
Well, maybe not okay, but you've heard the response. Yeah, thank you. Right. Well, now we'll adjourn until 1:45.
Yes, okay,
do you want to announce? Well, that's what I thought. We're adjourning now until 4:45.